Welcome to NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and cultural stories. I am Neda Ulaby. This week on Culturetopia, Tom Hanks talks about his latest film, Larry Crown. It's a story of reinvention amid recession. An actress's rise to international stardom represents a larger cultural shift in Peru. And Telemundo wants an Emmy for its biggest ever hit TV show. But Spanish-language television has never won an Emmy in any of the major categories. We look at its chances. But first.
This is Jeopardy!
Imagine this. You've got 30 seconds on national television to share the most interesting thing about yourself. What do you say?
This young man doesn't eat fruit. Ellen Hostetter used an infrared camera to do what?
I want to know about your cat.
Says here that your father got a phone call from a young girl who was looking for...
Justin Timberlake.
Our producer, Brent Bachman, is obsessed with Jeopardy, especially these personal anecdotes. He reports on how the smartest people on television survive the most nerve-wracking 30 seconds of their lives.
The first key to your survival on Jeopardy? Maggie, speak.
Hey, Brent, how are you?
Maggie and Robert James, not James Robert. That happens to you, like, every day, I bet.
Every day of my life.
These two, Maggie and Robert, are a Jeopardy contestant's best friends. They're the show's contestant coordinators.
Yeah, they're your lifeline. They're your best friends. And they're wonderful. They're really, really good at their jobs.
Trisha McKinney was a contestant on the show back in 2007. She was excited to land a spot until she received her three-page contestant questionnaire from Maggie and Robert. Do you have the sheet in front of you there?
I have. Yes, I do. Point A, be brief. Really, we're looking for one-liners. After all, that's the real reason we're here, to win lots of money. And surprise us. Tell us something about yourself or something you've done that no one else would guess about you.
Have you ever been at a turning point in your career?
Brushes with greatness and secret ambitions.
What's the most romantic thing you've ever done?
Man, it's all coming back to me when you read me that.
Here are some memorable examples from last season. Fabio saved my life. I broke my toe while chasing a bear.
I just panicked.
I used to recruit spies for the CIA.
I panicked. I remember agonizing.
Hours and hours and hours.
I love you, Alex Trebek.
I wanted to be cool.
I didn't do it just right. I wanted to come up with something.
Make Alex Trebek say, I want to be your best friend.
And that's totally not what happened.
If you didn't get some of those examples of good anecdotes, I once broke my toe while chasing a bear. I used to recruit spies for the CIA. That's the bar you get as a contestant. People who run toward bears, not away from them. CIA spies. So before the show, Robert James sits down with each contestant to settle on three of their best anecdotes from the questionnaire. That often requires more work. Once, after responding to all the questions on the form, a contestant settled on the most interesting thing he could share. I like to walk.
I like to walk, but we all like to walk. You know, we got to come up with something more. And we worked with him, and he came with some good stories. People don't often realize what's interesting about themselves.
All this happens before the contestants make it to their taping. And when they get there, here's Trisha McKinney again.
We were so excited to be there and to meet Alex Trebek. He's like a rock star.
So you have meeting a rock star nerves. And here's the other thing. Jeopardy tapes 5 shows a day. That means as a player, you could potentially win 5 times, which means 5 changes of clothes, 5 personal anecdotes, and 5 games worth of contestants all in the same room.
12 really twitchy, crazy people who are all dying to go on TV and be famous and win a lot of money. Everybody in the room wants to beat everybody else in the room.
So the contestant coordinators step in again.
And so they have to just spend probably a good half a day just calming everybody down. They sit with you, just making sure nobody throws up.
People tell me that, you know, they're thrilled to play the game. A lot of people are like, this is the scariest part, is this chat thing. But the thing is, Alex is so good at his job. He will bail you out.
This is Dan Sussman's anecdote. He was on the show December 28th, 2004.
Maryland. Most people, when they think of Africa and wildlife in Africa, think of lions.
He built it up as a very dramatic experience.
Well, my dad's from South Africa, so we go over there occasionally. And we're fishing on a lake in Botswana when I noticed that there was a new island moving towards us. And it was a hippopotamus chasing us. So that was a little scary. I think more
and then, just like that, it's gone.
Yeah, and you can focus back on the game, on the score. The other people next to you are going to bobble the questions themselves.
Did you feel as nervous during the actual quiz portion of the show as you did during the story?
Not at all. I know how to answer questions.
In a way, it's comforting that there are still people in America who simply have no idea what to do with themselves in front of a camera. People who have the humility to be nervous, they're taking up your time. Dan Sisman didn't win his game. Trisha McKinney did. She won 3 times, over $50,000. She remembers the last story she told.
It was a story about my cousin and me. We went to Germany, and we found this shop that we really liked, but it was closed, so we were going to come back another day. So we tried to memorize the name of the street the shop was on, and so we memorized the name Einbahnstraße, which we later came to find out means one-way street in German.
Why is that funny?
Because there's a lot of one-way streets.
Oh, okay.
I know, right? This is the quality anecdote that I had to work with.
Of course, Maggie Speak says it's easy to make fun of someone else's story.
What would you talk about?
Don't ask me that.
Have you been anywhere interesting?
See, this is like, I could not do it.
Producer Brent Bachman isn't going on Jeopardy anytime soon.
More than half of the people who live in Peru are of indigenous descent, and many of them are poor. But that's changing. Peru's economy is booming, its democracy is gaining traction, and indigenous Peruvians are finally beginning to move into positions of power. The most prominent example is the recently elected president. Annie Murphy has a profile of another rising international star.
A few years ago, the Peruvian film The Milk of Sorrow received top honors at the Berlin Film Festival. And on stage, Magali Solier, the actress who plays the film's protagonist, did something surprising. She chose to accept the award by singing in the indigenous Quechua language. Solier grew up in a family of Quechua farmers in Peru's highlands. Whether speaking or singing, she often calls on Quechua in addition to Spanish. But even though more than half of Peruvians are indigenous or have indigenous roots, she says she was cautioned against speaking Quechua in public.
People thought that I would be laughed at. My family, my friends, they told me, don't speak in Quechua. You'll be humiliated. You'll get knocked down. You'll be made fun of. I said, why do I have to beat around the bush? Why can't I speak whatever language I want?
Solier clearly has her own take on how to do things. She says that has a lot to do with growing up in a place that was affected by violent repression during the 1980s.
Tenías que hacer silencio porque si hacías bulla.
You always had to be quiet when I was growing up. If you made noise, the Shining Path guerrillas would come, take you away, and kill you. And in the end, it was the local people who got rid of the violence, who began to arm themselves and make rounds to keep the community safe.
In the film, The Milk of Sorrow, Solier plays a young woman affected by the rural violence of the 80s, living in modern-day Peru. During the time of Peru's armed conflict, some Peruvians believed that campesina women who were raped could pass their fear onto their children through their breast milk. Solier's character is one of those children grown up. In the scene, she angrily asks why city people don't grow potatoes, which are a symbol of rural life in Peru. The movie catapulted her into a successful international career. Throughout the film, she also sings, and she's since become a professional singer, too.
When I got to Lima, the music I'd sung growing up was looked down upon. It was something that people thought was only good for getting drunk and getting into fights. I said to myself, people in the capital and foreigners, they don't know what the music is really like where I'm from. I wanted to do something different.
Solier is part of a larger cultural shift in Peru. That shift is also visible in the election of Ollanta Humala, who's of indigenous descent, as Peru's next president. Nonetheless, many people were jolted by his election. Magali Solier believes they should wait until Humala is actually in office to make up their minds about him.
Whether he'll do good or bad, no one knows yet. human beings that haven't had the same opportunities, you have to give us a chance in order to find out what we'll actually do.
For NPR News, I'm Annie Murphy in Lima, Peru.
And you can hear more of Magaly Solier singing on our website, npr.org.
And we're going to spend some time now with actor Tom Hanks, or should I say Larry Crown, the hero of his new movie, also called Larry Crown. But Hanks isn't just the star, he's also the director and co-writer. In the film, Larry is a loyal employee at a big box store, U-Mart. He loves his job and he knows a lot about his merchandise, but he gets fired, he's told, because he never went to college. So Larry dusts himself off and heads to community college. There he meets a margarita-swilling speech teacher played by Julia Roberts, and she has some navigation issues of her own.
Oh, I'm just drowning out the GPS.
Please enter.
See? It never stops.
Well, no wonder. That's a map genie. Back when I sold you such things, I would have steered you toward a vortex, because the map genie has... it's very complicated. Oh. Well, no wonder the auto-on feature is engaged. So, menu, select... features, auto, voice select, change, yes, on, off, off, change, yes, save, and back, and exit.
It was fun watching you in the U-Mart.
Oh, yeah.
It made me wonder if you spend time in Kmarts or Walmarts or...
Of late, I go to places like Kmart and Walmart when I am in location in other places. And I was here in L.A. and I was doing some Christmas shopping out in the valley, and I went to a Target, and I swear it was such a big store that you could see the curvature of the earth as you look down the main Broadway aisle that went all the way to the other end of the store. When we were scouting for our film, and we ended up shooting in a Kmart, and I was amazed by the bargains. I bought everything from... a 50-pound sack of Japanese rice, a pitcher for iced tea, a fishing pole. I bought some nice kind of like sandals, open-toed mandals, you know, those kind of things that you wear in the summertime.
Do you wear them with or without socks?
Without socks. I'm not from Denmark.
You're pretty comfortable in the kitchen in this film. Do you do a lot of cooking yourself?
I'm really great at breakfast, man. I tell you, I'm the happy morning guy in my house. Breakfast is my thing. Get out of my way. I can put on a breakfast table that, honestly, we could charge, you know, $40 and call it a Sunday brunch. I could do a 20-minute segment on, what is it, the Roving Kitchen? What's the name of that show? That
oh, Splendid Table. Is that what you're talking
about? Oh, that's
about?
It. That's it. Yeah, that's the one. I don't know, breakfast with a cup of coffee and a click and clack, the Tappet Brothers playing in the background.
Of course.
That's a fine Saturday or Sunday.
Your character... Larry Crown, he has to reinvent himself, and he does that in part by starting to take classes at a community college. And you yourself spent some time at a junior college, and that's where you met someone who helped inspire this character?
Well, I went to 2 years of junior college right out of high school because I had nowhere else to go, really. I didn't have the grades or the finances to go to a real university. In my classes, which were all those kind of like ology 101 classes, you know, self-sociology 101, zoology 101. I was sitting sometimes right next to people who were twice my age, mothers whose kids had gone out of the house, or there were divorced guys. There were people there who were retired and taking on new jobs. And there were also guys who were just back from Vietnam, because this was 74, 75. And we were in the same exact boat as far as our fears go and our possibilities for what the future was. I was just starting out in my adult life, and they were all starting out brand new versions of what their adult life was going to be. And that did always stick with me as this kind of great meeting place for cross-generational learning.
Mr. Hanks, you not only star in this movie, you also co-wrote and directed this film. And that means that you're the guy who calls the shots.
You bet.
And as good as that feels, I wonder if there's a moment where you weren't quite sure of what to do, if you questioned your own judgment and perhaps wished for just a second that Steven Spielberg or Robert Zemeckis was there behind the camera to give you a little bit of guidance.
Well, they sort of are, because, you know, I've been to a clinic every time I've gone to work as an actor with all of the directors that I've worked with. directing a movie, certainly writing a movie and then directing the result of that script is a personal virus that you have to fight. It's a fever that you get that takes you over. And from the moment I decided to direct the film, I thought, well, what would Nora Ephron do in this position? What would Jonathan Demme do? What would Steven do? What would Bob Zemeckis do? And they're never the same exact things, but what they would do is they would plow forward. You're always protecting the color and the timbre and the shade, the tenor, whatever descriptive word you want to use for what the movie is somewhere on the storytelling graph. And that comes down to the guy who makes the film.
So while you're doing all this, you're also the guy that stars in the film. So when do you ever get a moment to catch your breath?
Well, you don't, but you understand that it's a sprint. I must say that, you know, I'm in costume. I'm there. The whole thing is in one's head and laid down anyway. I don't want to discount the amount of work that goes in prior to it, because that's where the real preparation is. On the day, on the set, getting ready for the shot, it's not all that different from other positions that I've been lucky enough to be in as an actor, where you work all day, you're in more or less every scene, and the best place to be is right next to the camera all day, so you're just ready to step into it when the lights are set. That's not that different. The big difference is in the 6 months prior to that day. That's when it's hard to go back and forth between being a director who wants to tell a story with a specific sort of sound and look to it, as opposed to the actor just saying, and what am I going to say here exactly, and why am I saying it? That's where the battle between being a director and actor is really fought.
This movie is really about reinvention, and it made me wonder, if you weren't as good as you are at what you do, if you weren't acting or directing or writing or...
I mean, if I wasn't in
scoping
show
the world, if you weren't in show business, yeah, what would you be doing instead?
Well, this is a movie that is about the battle against cynicism, of not giving in to that form of cynicism. And I think if I wasn't in show business, I would still be a guy who has little cynicism. I mean, I have kept my sense of humor, and I kind of like wake up in a positive outlook as much today as I did when I was 8 years old, according to my own memory. And if I had my druthers, I think I would get the most satisfaction by being like a tour guide at some great historical location. Have you ever taken, for example, the Circle Line in New York City?
Yes, I have.
All right. I went on the Circle Line when we were doing Bonfire of the Vanities. This is how long ago. And this older gentleman, he must have been in his 60s. He kept up the most gracious conversation. He talked about how the Maxwell House Coffee Factory over in New Jersey. He said on the days when you were growing up, the smell of coffee would come across the river, and you could smell it in Lower Manhattan. And I swear when he said that, I thought I could smell the coffee myself that day. It's those kind of, that's the job that I would love to have, because I'd still be telling stories somehow. And I'd still be able to, I think, be searching out the least cynical stories to tell.
You know, you still can. Tom Hanks is a docent.
Not bad. What's not? You know what? As soon as Larry Crown opens, I'm going to start giving tours at Independence Hall in Philadelphia.
I'd sign up.
listen, you'd have a good time. You'd learn a few things, too.
Tom Hanks, it's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you, Michelle.
So much.
My pleasure. Hey, everybody, send in those pledge checks.
And you might get a coffee mug.
Thank you.
Tom Hanks, his new movie is Larry Crown, and it opens next week. During our interview, he also confessed to a love affair that, in his words, has taken over his life. You can hear about Tom Hanks' passion for vintage typewriters at NPR.org.
Nominations for this year's Primetime Emmy Awards close today. TV networks have been waging slick ad campaigns on behalf of their shows, actors, and actresses. And this year there is a newcomer to the Emmy campaign. The Spanish-language network Telemundo is seeking to become the first Spanish network to win a Primetime Emmy. Telemundo is promoting its hit, The Queen of the South, in Spanish, La Reina del Sur. NPR's Carrie Kahn is here to check my Spanish pronunciation.
La Reina del Sur chronicles the life of a naive Mexican woman who falls in love with a drug lord and stumbles into becoming one of the world's most powerful traffickers. In the season opener, up-and-coming narco Teresa Mendoza, played by Mexican-born actress Kate del Castillo, runs from ruthless drug thugs and aqua blue stiletto heels. Through the next 62 episodes, the show is shot in four different countries with multiple casts and in high definition.
The quality of the production was amazing, definitely.
Martha Sarabia is the entertainment reporter for LA's La Opinión newspaper.
You usually don't see that kind of quality, especially all that money that was put into making it.
especially on Spanish-language TV's nightly lineup of telenovelas or soap operas. Telemundo's high-priced gamble paid off. La Reina del Sur was the biggest hit in the network's history, and the season finale last month even beat out English-language networks in all the major markets. Telemundo's vice president of entertainment, Joshua Mintz, says the ratings were phenomenal and deserving of an Emmy.
It's a series that hooked millions of people for 62 episodes, night after night after night. And I don't know any other product in general market, in our, you know, in American television, that can that have done that.
But while La Reina del Sur played well with Spanish-speaking audiences and even had some crossover appeal, the bulk of the voters in the Television Academy don't speak Spanish, and getting them to give it a chance is a tough task. But despite the obstacles, senior editor for The Hollywood Reporter, Alex Ben Block, says the Emmy campaign is money well spent by Telemundo.
Because they want to get the word out about the amazing growth of the network and the tremendous growth of the Spanish language programming in the United States. And this is as much about marketing as it is about winning.
Telemundo mailed out 5,000 DVDs with English subtitles, placed ads in trade papers, and held screenings in L.A. Actress and part-time nurse Julia Lippard liked the show, especially that the lead character was a strong woman.
I actually enjoyed the fact that she didn't just lay over and die or just be like, oh my gosh, I can't do anything.
It was the action-packed suspense that won over Peter Pasco. He's also an actor and a voting member.
I think it's really, it's nice. Like it's kind of like Weeds meets 24.
The show's lead actress, Kate del Castillo, actually had a recurring role on Showtime's hit Weeds. She played Pilar, a fiery Mexican crime figure. Del Castillo says she's not worried about getting typecast. She says there was so much more to the lead character, Teresa, in La Reina del Sur.
She makes the wrong decisions. She makes mistakes. She contradicts herself. She smokes pot. She sleeps around. She sleeps with married men. She drinks tequila. And people love her.
Del Castillo says she never worked so hard or has been so proud of her work and the show's phenomenal ratings. She says an Emmy nomination would be even more amazing.
I would just be more humble and thankful and grateful for doing what I love and what is my passion and taking it to another level.
But she says she's practical, too, and realizes the chances of her name alongside frontrunners Kira Sedgwick, Kathy Bates, and Juliana Margulies is a long shot. Carrie Kahn, NPR News.
The Emmy Awards are months away, but right now is a crucial time for the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences. Members have until Friday to make their picks for Emmy nominations. That means TV critics and bloggers are burning up their keyboards, hoping to build support for their Emmy favorites. Eric Deggans is a TV and media critic for the St. Petersburg Times, and he's taken time out from his keyboard to chat with us. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So I'm interested to know what performances you think are Emmy-worthy. There are tons of eligible actors in each of the awards, 40 or 60 in a category. Are they trying to boil it down now to five nominees? That's right?
Yes. There's plenty of people who we expect to be recognized. Steve Carell will probably get a nomination for his final season on The Office. We expect that Hugh Laurie from House might get nominated because this might be his second to last season on House, and he's never actually won one. He's been nominated a lot. We expect Jon Hamm from Mad Men to get nominated. But I feel like there's some people who don't get quite so much attention who we might also want to take a look at.
So beyond the obvious, is there an actress you like?
Most definitely. I think one of the interesting things that's happening with the actress category is that a lot of great actresses are actually nominated in the supporting categories. Regina King from Southland, who plays this great female detective.
She almost stole the show.
She almost stole the show, and I have no idea why she was nominated as a supporting actress, other than perhaps they figure there might be a little less competition there. But we also had Kelly MacDonald from Boardwalk Empire. She played this great Irish immigrant housewife who becomes a girlfriend to a mobster in training. Condi Alexander from Tremé, you know, she did a great job. But my real favorite is Margot Martindale from Justified. She plays the matriarch of a drug-dealing family in rural Kentucky, and we've got this great clip of her telling off one of her rivals during a parlay, as they call it.
Aside from money, what is business but contracts and agreements? You and me, we had an agreement. I gave up my family's claim on this county, but for one thing, the pot business.
That is true, Mags, but then your son Dickie approached
me. You didn't shake hands with Dickie, you shook hands with me. We had a deal and you broke it.
She sounds like someone you don't want to mess with.
Oh, you gotta love her. And TV fans will recognize the actress. She was on Dexter, but here she gets to play a crime kingpin in Kentucky, and she does an amazing job with it.
Are there actors that you're also talking about?
Oh, yeah. Well, I loved Andrew Lincoln in The Walking Dead. He is actually a British actor who played a Southern sheriff who winds up stuck in this world where zombies come to life. Aziz Ansari on Parks and Recreation, he plays a really wacky character who's sort of like your ultimate office mate gone bad. And Nick Offerman, who's also on that show, plays sort of the head of the department with an awesome mustache and an even awesomer taste for being really politically incorrect. I just love his character. But I gotta give it to Peter Dinklage on Game of Thrones. He's the dwarf son of a powerful lord in this sort of medieval Lord of the Rings type drama on HBO. It just concluded on Sunday, and we've got this clip of him coaching the misfit son of another powerful family about how to handle being an outcast in this world.
Let me give you some advice, bastard. Never forget what you are. The rest of the world will not. Wear it like armor, and it can never be used to hurt you.
He's just an amazing character. And now that it's all aired, if you have HBO, you can probably go back and see all the episodes on demand.
When are these Emmy nominations announced?
The nominations are announced on July 14th, and then we'll see the winners announced in September.
Eric Deggans, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's Eric Deggans of the St. Petersburg Times. He watches TV, so we don't have to.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I am Neda Ulibe. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.